Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much for coming and listening. As Rabbi Raff said, kaparot is something that in our religion is a little bit interesting. Because essentially, of course, since it's a halachic issue, the idea of one taking their sins and transferring them in some form or fashion to a chicken, how far that goes, different rabbanim have different opinions as to how Jewish such a tradition is. If you take a look on the Nosei Kelim, all the commentaries that surround the Shulchan Aruch, almost all of them warn that if someone's doing kaparot, it's ideal to use a white chicken, but a person should not specifically seek a white chicken because that looks too much like Darche Amori, which Darche Amori, I'm not really sure how to translate it, but something on not part of our religion, to put it mildly. So on the one hand, it seems that most of the Achronim realize that kaparot have an aspect which is not necessarily 100% in tune with what we try to accomplish in Erev Yom Kippur. As Rabbi Rat mentioned, if you take a look at the Shulchan Aruch itself, the Mechaber, he writes, and he's quoting the Rashba and the Ramban, that in general, the tradition of doing kaparot with a chicken should be discouraged. And he says that it's, that's as far as he goes. He says, Yishlim Noam and Hadzel, let's sort of press it down. And of course, many Sephardi communities don't do kaparot with a chicken, for sure. On the other hand, the Ashkenazim, the Ramah, quoting the Tur, who quotes his father, the Rosh, verbatim, says that the kaparos is an ancient tradition going back to the time of the Gaonim, and it's a beautiful tradition. However you want to understand kaparot and whether it's your tradition to do it, many of the later Achronim point out a great danger with kaparot. And the great danger with kaparot is not whether or not so one is violating Darche Amori, but rather, what happens to the chicken after the kaparot? The shochtim are overwhelmed. And if you go to any of the kaparot, if you see the kaparot that happened in many neighborhoods in this city, and the Aruch HaShulchan says it was happening in his time also, the shochtim have many, many chickens that they have to worry about, many chickens that theoretically they have to shecht, and it's just not always possible for them to do it appropriately. And if you happen to be driving through Muncie on Erev Yom Kippur, and you keep your eyes open, you'll very often see on the side of the road huge flocks of chickens wandering aimlessly through various forests. Because, I don't want to be choshe b'ksherim, but it's theoretically possible that many shechtim, not having enough time to shecht all the chickens, simply release them. And many a times I get calls, people are driving who knows where, New Jersey, I've got, you know, you'll never believe what I saw walking along the side of the road. And I don't need them to complete the sentence. I know what they saw. Erev Yom Kippur, they saw hundreds and hundreds of chickens. And of course, if you're saying on kaparos and you're saying Zeh HaTarnagol Yelech L'Misa, you're saying this chicken is going to die, there's something to be said for that chicken actually dying. Ideally, we don't want the chicken to die for nothing. We don't want to have Valtashkos. And you also want to have either the chicken being consumed or going for others positive purpose. And this was something that many of the Achronim were very worried about. Because when people were going and they were shechting the chickens, the shechtim weren't doing a good job. The people cleaning the chickens weren't doing a good job. And the whole system, instead of somebody doing a mitzvah on Erev Yom Kippur, or at least of Shechita, Kisui Hadam, maybe Tzakef, they gave the chicken to an Ani. Instead, they're doing some minhag, which might be an ancient minhag, but they're also Chas V'Chalil on Erev Yom Kippur, they could be violating a lot of Isuri Deraisa, including Tarfus, Baltashkis, and of course, if you're a Pita member, Tzar Balichayim. So what we thought was a good idea, specifically because it is Tzom Gedalia, which has the two very important applications for today. First of all, many people have the minhag to do kaparot on Tzom Gedalia. The other issue is you can't eat anyways, so this is the ideal time to look at the pictures in the pamphlet. And we wanted to go through just the basics of not Hilchot Shechita, but what's involved in A, choosing a kosher bird, and B, making sure that the kosher bird is, in fact, consumable. You'll notice that all the pictures I have here are of a chicken, but you'll see that later. I know that many of you are very familiar, specifically if you're learning Chulin, with Rabbi Lach's Sefer Chulin Illuminated. I think it's a fantastic Sefer. He did not focus on chickens. He did give me permission to use his pictures, but this is on chickens. He did it primarily on animals, so there's very little overlap in terms of what we're going to do today. And I invite you to, I think you can keep these booklets. You'll see that the pictures are, Baruch Hashem, the printer worked very well, so they're high quality. Now, if you're doing kapara, or if you're eating a bird, you have to eat a kosher bird. And if you're doing a kapara, you're allowed to use, it seems that there was even a minhag to use animals, but the bottom line is you could use any bird for a kapara as long as it's not one of the birds that's brought on the Mizbeach. In America, you'd think that, well, you don't have too many birds that are brought on the Mizbeach, but the pigeons and the doves, the pigeon, as you know, is a yonah, and the dove is a tor, so we're nohig not to use them, even if they're wrong age, because we don't want people to think they're actually bringing a korban. So on the first hand, you can't use a pigeon or a dove for a kapara. You can eat them, though. And sparrows, many people are of the opinion that that is the tzipor dror, the bird that the metzora would bring. So if you decide that you want to save a little money and you don't want to do kaparos on a chicken, you can do kaparos on other birds. Just make sure you don't use a pigeon, a dove, and a sparrow. In terms of identifying kosher birds, and that's where, if you want to follow along with me, all the kosher animals, fish, locusts, if you're interested, they have specific signs that they can be identified. If you look in the Torah, right, kosher animals, split hooves, chew their cud. A fish, fins and scales. The locust, karsulaim, they have a special kind of a leg. With birds, the Torah does not give us any simonim, any way to identify kosher birds. The only way that we can identify kosher birds, theoretically, is we have a list in Vayikra and in Devarim of the non-kosher birds. If you do the math, it comes out to somewhere around 24. And by calculating those 24, any bird not one of the 24, theoretically would be kosher. Obviously, when people were living in Israel, and they had a direct line of Mesorah from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, so people knew which bird was which. People knew that Moshe, whatever Moshe identified as a Nesher, still flying around, father to son, people could identify the 24 birds listed in the Torah. We're not sure when this fell apart. According to some of the Rishonim, it happened at the time of the Gemara, and for sure by the time of the Rishonim, we could no longer identify the 24 birds that the Torah says are forbidden. To give you an idea of how unsure we are of the 24 species, of the 24 species listed in the Torah, there is not a single bird which is unanimously agreed among the Rishonim as to its identification. Even the birds that everyone, you know, is taught in grade school, I know everyone's taught the Chasida is the stork, but that's a machlokas between the Rabbeinu Yeruchim and the Rosh. The Orev, whether it's a crow or a vulture, and there are many other birds, there's not a single one that the Rishonim agree what it is. So the result is that the list of 24 species that the Torah gives us that are forbidden, it's very important obviously, but it doesn't help us that much because we can't identify any of the birds on that list. So the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Nun Teh, has a list of four signs through which kosher birds can be identified. And these four signs, we're not really sure of the origins, but it seems that according to the Bali Tosfos, this was a major discovery of probably one of the world's first genuine scientists, Noah. I mean, nobody thinks about this, but Lemaisa, he's stuck on the Teva, 40 days, 40 nights at least, and then while the waters are receding. But when the waters are going up, he had nothing to do, so he's looking at all the animals. And according to the Bali Tosfos, Noah realized that there was a major difference between the kosher and the non-kosher birds. And his discovery is recorded in the Mishnah in Chulin. And it's the Bali Tosfos based this on the fact that when Noah comes out of the Teva, the Torah tells us that he brought a sacrifice from every one of the kosher species. So he was all excited. He made this discovery. He knew which animals and birds were kosher and non-kosher. And in the celebration when he left the Teva, he sacrificed those that were kosher, those that could be sacrificed. If you take a look at the first page, we have the four signs through which you could identify kosher birds. According to the Gemara, the number one rule is that none of the kosher birds are birds of prey. That means if you think that an eagle might be the nesher listed in the Torah, might be, but for sure an eagle, which we all know is a bird of prey, can't be kosher. And the identification of a bird of prey in the Torah is slightly different than the scientific definition. And I say slightly different because scientists are constantly revising their definition. The Torah says, I'm sorry, the Gemara says that a bird of prey, when it eats, it uses its foot. And it either stands on its food or it picks its food up with its foot. If you take a look at this picture of a parrot, this is, I don't even know, it's actually a lorry, but it's the same idea. If you take a look at the picture, you'll see that it's holding a grape in its hand and it's eating it. Now the parrot is strictly vegetarian, theoretically, except for one that lives in New Zealand. But all in all, parrots tend to be vegetarian. They hold the food in their hand, they lift it and they eat it with their mouth. So according to every single Rishon who has a definition of Doris, the parrot would qualify as a Doris. It also stands, if you take a look at the other foot, the one that's not holding the grape, you'll see there are two toes in front. The parrot has a total of four toes. Two toes face one direction, two toes face the other direction. This bird behaves like a bird of prey. Halachically, we consider it a Doris, a bird of prey. But in reality, scientifically, it's not considered a bird of prey. Before we get into, and we won't get into, the scientific aspect, I just want to tell you that, it's 4 years ago, I was at the Museum of Natural History, and I had a special deal with them. Well, they had a problem, because by law, any exotic migratory bird that gets hit by a car or something on the highways, they have to conduct an autopsy. And they had no idea, and they're not allowed to get rid of the birds. There are all these laws of what they have to do with all these birds. So they had tons and tons of dead hawks and owls, and they had no clue what to do with them. So I asked them if I could do research and go and look at all the stomachs. And when I went down, and we'll get to why I was looking at the stomachs later, but when I explained to them that I needed to look at the stomachs, they were mowed in. No one had ever done any research into the similarity between the stomach of a hawk and an owl. But they also asked me, we really know a lot about birds here. What are you looking for? And I said, I want to identify a predator. So they said, well, we have books written about that. And I told them that, you know, in the Torah, we have a tradition. I quoted Rav Sajigon. Rav Sajigon translated to Arabic every one of the non-kosher birds. He happened to have a Masorah on what they were. And he wrote that the Anafa, which is one of the birds listed in the Torah as not kosher, is a parrot. So I told them, I said, listen, in our tradition, we believe that the parrot is very closely related to the falcon. And I know that in scientific literature, that's no longer the case. As luck would have it, they had just been doing research on falcons and parrots at that specific department, and they told me that was their major discovery. That they had cracked the genome of the falcon and the parrot, and realized that previously it was assumed that the closest relative to the falcon was an eagle or something like that. And now, when they had further researched the genomes and the, however they look at these things, they realized the closest relative of the falcon is actually the parrot. So then I said, well, so now we're both in agreement they're closely related, but the parrot is strictly vegetarian. And they said, no, that's a mistake. The parrot eats primarily fruits and vegetables. But the breeders, if they want to have super healthy parrots, because the more babies it produces, the more money you get, they feed them meat. And even though the parrot in the wild, in nature, will choose to eat fruits and vegetables primarily, if you can get your parrot to eat meat, I'm not saying you should try this at home, but if you do, you'll see it eats chicken. Once it eats it once, it won't stop. They do much better. And of course, they also mentioned that there were parrots, specifically in New Zealand, which were bidafka predatory, which go and attack sheep and tear them apart. So anyways, in our tradition, the first sign of a non-kosher bird is that it's a bird of prey. The second sign of a non-kosher bird is what we call, if you look on page 6, but the pictures are on all the pages until there too, we have what's called an etzba yeterim. Kosher birds have one toe or part of a toe which doesn't really serve the same function as the other toes. As you saw in the first picture, the first page, the parakeet has four toes, and they're all approximately the same size, and they all have approximately the same function. If you look on page 6, I have a picture of a chicken, and you'll notice on the picture of the chicken that it has the four toes. Toes are numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4. Toe number 2 is extra long, and toe number 4 is extra short. Depending on which Rishon is your favorite, the extra long toe or the extra short toe doesn't really serve a genuine function for the birds. And if you look at all the kosher birds, they all have a toe which really they don't use. And I don't mean for balance, which if you take a look at how a chicken stands, it doesn't use the fourth toe for balance, but also it can't grab anything with it. When it sits, if you look at the previous page, if you look at page 5, I have a picture of a pigeon. When it's grabbing onto a small twig or something, it doesn't really use its back toe. So it's an extra toe in the extent that its functionality is a bit questionable. You'll also notice, if you're into nature videos and stuff, if you see a picture of an eagle flying with a fish, it will hold the fish in its claws. However, kosher birds are unable to grasp anything with their claws, and they're not able to pick anything up. So if you look at, you know, even the longest legs, a pigeon or whatever, that have really long toes, they can perhaps wrap their toes around something, but they can't grab. Their inability to grab also means they can't attack another bird, right? Because they can't grab it and tear it apart. Whereas an eagle can use its claws to scrape and attack. You can get scratched. Don't get me wrong. You can get scratched by a kosher bird, but they can't rip in and tear. All right. The third sign is the zefek, which if you take a look on page 7, I can translate it to English, but I don't know if that'll help you. But if you look at the picture, that's what it is. The zefek is a crop. On the base of the food pipe, there's a little balloon-like sac, which gets bigger and bigger with food. And that's called the zefek. And finally, on page 8, we have what's called the kurkuba niklas biyad. All birds have some kind of a stomach. Birds do not have teeth. Kosher birds, instead of teeth, what they do is they swallow pebbles. And inside the stomach, through the movements of the stomach, they're able to grind their food the way we use our molars. That's called the kurkuban. There's a major difference, and if you take a look, you can see the difference on page 9, between the stomach of a kosher bird and the stomach of the aforementioned owls and hawks, which were so kindly provided by the Museum of Natural History. And that is, the kurkuban of a kosher bird is very muscular, because they're primarily eating seeds and things that are harder to break down. Whereas, if you take a look at page 9, you'll see the hawk and the owl actually has a pretty powerful gizzard. But on the bottom page 9, you see the gizzard of a hawk, and that's very flimsy because it's eating primarily meat. So it doesn't need to grind anything up. We have, according to the Gemara, if a bird has all these four signs, the bird is, according to the Gemara, then it's a kosher bird. It cannot be on the list of forbidden species if it has those four signs. However, the last note on the kosher signs, the later Rishonim, noting that this was already a problem with the Gemara, realized people aren't so good at figuring out if birds have the four signs. And what was happening, and the Gemara has stories, and the stories get worse and worse as you go through Jewish history, that people thought that a bird had all the signs of a kosher bird, and then they discovered it didn't, and that someone made a miss, you know, they thought it wasn't a bird of prey, and then they saw it, you know, acting like a bird of prey. They thought its kurkuban, its stomach would separate properly, and then they reanalyzed and they discovered it didn't. So we, as the Ashkenazi community, have a tradition to only eat birds if we have what's called a mesorah, which means we have a tradition going back to the time everyone knew which were the 24 birds listed in the Torah, and we have a tradition that this bird is not one of those 24 forbidden birds. Once you have an idea of which birds you can eat, I wanted to very quickly go over with you how you could sort of figure out if the bird itself is kosher. If you're learning Kulin, this will be very helpful. If you're not learning Kulin, this is also good, especially if you're doing Kafara, so if you ever want to kosher any meat, or more importantly, if you're doing Kafaros and you want to make sure the meat is kosher. If you take a look on page 11 and 12, I have a kurkuban, one of which, the smaller one, is not nikluf, and the second one is nikluf. The idea, what I told you, one of the signs of a kosher bird is that a korban is nikluf. That means you can grab the korban with your hands, and, I mean, live demonstration, and it'll separate into two membranes. You can see the separated korban on page 11, where you have part of the I don't know what you'd call that yellow thing, right? Peels off, and it reveals what looks like a regular piece of meat. Especially if you buy your meat in bulk, you'll find that a lot of those are sort of hanging out at the bottom of the bag of chicken. Some people call it pipik. It's the gizzard. If you take a look at this korban, not only does it prove that the chicken, surprise, surprise, is a kosher bird, but it also, you'll see that it's a very, it's a kosher korban. The meat is the right color. Also compliments to Rabbi Kolinsky and the YU printing, but it came out the right shade of the color. Sometimes when you look at a korban, they're deformed, which means that they get discolored. If you get a chicken and it has the right korban in it, and this has happened to a lot of people, and you notice that the korban is the wrong color, you have a real halachic problem, because if the membranes were punctured, so that's it, the chicken's treif. And you can't see necessarily if the korban is cut how it was punctured, but based on the coloration you could see the quality of the korban that you have. I have a picture on page 14 of a korban which, by the way it was cut, we could not tell how it was punctured, but the meat is a totally different color. And what actually happened was there was a children's camp run by the Klausenberg Hasidim, and I lent them animals. They couldn't give it back. It's a long story, but we shechted their ducks, and they had all the Klausenberg children would throw coins to the ducks, and the ducks would eat these coins. I didn't say they were smart ducks. They were just hungry ducks. And they would eat these coins, and they would get stuck in their stomach. So the rubbing of the coin caused this korban to be deformed, and it actually was punctured. I couldn't, when we cut, the way a korban comes, if you take a look at the top of page 14, it's closed. So when it was closed, it looked fine. But once we cut the korban open, it was discolored. I couldn't tell if there was any puncture. We went and we asked the Dayanim of Klausenberg, because we were at their camp, and they thought that it was a Dover Pasha, that it was punctured. But the bottom line is you can see the difference in coloration. If you get a korban that's black, you probably don't want to eat it anyways, because if it's not punctured because of a neck of a specific, you know, metal implement or something puncturing, it's probably diseased. But Hamevin Yavin, but the bottom line is, the second thing is the liver. I have a picture there of a liver on page 15. The livers, very rarely will you find a tarfus with the liver, but there's another interesting issue that we have with livers, which is the age-old machlokus of foie gras. If you compare the picture on page 15 to the picture on page 17, you see what you can do to a liver, especially if you happen to live in France or Hungary, where they're very into doing this, which is you can take a bird and you can stuff it full of food. And it's really, I don't know how to describe it. You basically, you grab the bird, you hold it between your legs, you wrench open its mouth, you stick something down its throat, and then you start stuffing food down. And if you stuff down its throat much more food than it can eat, it becomes very, very sick. It's called anemic, which means all the blood, for some reason, I'm not the scientist here, drains out of the liver. As all the blood leaves, not only does the liver turn white, anemic, because all the blood of the liver leaves, but the liver gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the time the foie gras, the stuffed goose, is ready to be slaughtered, the liver, as you could see on page 17, is, I mean, bigger than a human hand, whereas a normal liver is probably, you could hold several of them in your hand. There was an age-old machlokus as to whether or not the bird is kosher or not. Lemaise, in America, we don't accept foie gras. In France, they do. The Bais Din of France, of Paris, accepts it, as does Bate Din in Brussels, which I think they do whatever the Bais Din of France does. But you also have in Hungary, there was a time in Israel they were accepting it until Pita got wind of the situation. It's a big machlokus. The OU does not accept foie gras, so I'm not trying to entice you to eat it, but I wanted to point out the difference in the livers. We paskin in Shulchan Aruch that a liver is entirely made out of blood. But on the other hand, you can drain all the blood out of the liver, and that is not the reason why people think that the liver is not kosher. The only reason there's a machlokus why the liver is not kosher is people aren't sure, if the bird would survive with a liver which is anemic and so much larger than the normal liver. Just so you should do parenthetically, they did tests to find out, the different Rabbanim, the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, to figure out if the bird could survive after it was stuffed. And both groups got a bunch of stuffed geese together, and they separated them, and as luck would have it, those people who were the Talmidim of the Rabbanim, who said that a goose with a stuffed liver could not survive, all those geese died. And those people who were the Talmidim of people who felt that a goose with a stuffed goose could survive, all those geese survived. There are different theories as to why this happened. Many people ascribe this, of course, to Elu ve'Elu. Other people think that perhaps the geese did not get the same treatment. Many people, perhaps zealous for the cover of their Rabbanim, made sure that certain geese got treatment like, you know, presidents of this world don't get. Well, you know. Okay. The interesting thing just about Shavgan, that's the last thing, the stuffed goose, if you look at page 16, I'm sorry, 18, you'll also notice that it doesn't behave like a normal piece of meat, it really behaves like a piece of fat. I'm just showing you in the pictures, you could read the notes, that if you put it over a fire, within 15 to 20 seconds, the whole thing turns into just liquid, which makes the shiloh had a kosher, but that's a different issue. Fatty liver. Oh, thank you. Okay. So Rabbi Avital Elkin, as you know, speaks French, so foie gras is fatty liver. So that would explain why it behaves like fat, I guess. Okay. It does behave like fat, so you can do the experiment. Okay, on page 19 and 20, we have lungs. It's much easier than doing the lungs in behemoth, because we don't really look for sirchot or anything like that. The only thing you want to look for lung is, first of all, you don't want the lung to still be in your chicken. If you get a chicken with the lung still inside, if there are pieces of chicken, of lung inside the chicken, then usually it's not a shiloh. But if the whole lungs are there, it becomes a shiloh in terms of the malicha. But if you take a look at the pictures here, I have on page 19, I have a normal lung. On page 20, I have a not normal lung. The top of the lung is black. Normally, if you clean out a chicken afterwards, depending on how you hold the chicken, this is simple biology, right? Gravity brings it down. So if you shove the chicken, you hold it like that, all the blood is going to go into the lung. If you hold it upside down, all the blood is going to go away from the lung. The other factor, though, is that even if the blood goes into the lung, you should be able to clean it out. And afterwards, the lung should look pretty much normal. If you take a look at this picture, what happened was, I don't know what the scientific terminology is, but we had a lung which had, it was black, ink black, as you could see in the picture, and it was solid. So that's some kind of a disease. And if you look at the Shulchan Aruch discusses black lungs, which, aside from the problem that causes smokers, it's also not good in chickens either, and it's one of the traces. Okay. And again, so that's what you have to look for in lungs. You want to make sure that the lungs are the right color. Sometimes you get lungs that are otherwise deformed, even if it's, again, this is specifically with avian influenza and all that stuff. The lungs that I've been seeing lately have become very good. But there used to be a time when I was first giving my shechita shir, where I would go into the guy who was selling the chickens, and I'd give him extra money if he could give me a chicken that was really, really sick. And inevitably, we would see all sorts of things in the lungs. But now they're scared of the police, so they don't, when you say something like that, they won't let you in their store anymore, because they think you're investigating something. But, yeah. I also wanted to show you, just so you could get an idea, page 21, it's the lung inside the chicken. Okay. Finally, the last thing, 22, we have what's called fleshig eggs. Fleshig eggs have very few halachic shilas. Unlike regular eggs, which sometimes have blood spots, but like stuff like that, the fleshig egg is an egg found inside a chicken. If you take an egg from inside the chicken, we treat it as meat, no matter how developed the egg is. If you take a look at the picture I call egg 1.2, I'm not good with the names, I apologize. That little dot in the middle is the approximate size of an egg when it's what's called on the eshkol. If you take a look inside the chicken, and you can see the picture on page 21, the eggs sort of collect in a cluster. It's called an eshkol, like a cluster of grapes. It's a cluster of eggs. And they're very small, and they get bigger and bigger until they're fully formed. The Shulchan Aruch has a lot of discussion about it. But the bottom line is that we paskin that you, if possible, you should treat the egg as meat at every point from the time it's really small until the time it's fully formed and emerges from the chicken. Of course, the egg when it's fully formed is not really 100% like meat. And if something goes wrong, you can read the Shulchan Aruch, you can read my my summaries over here, but you'll see that there is a lot that a lot of room to be lenient. But at least lechatchila, we treat all eggs like anything found inside a chicken as eggs. That's it. I hope that you have a Shana Tova. If you're zocher to do kaparos, you should know that many people, the Mishabur suggests this, that even if you do kaparos with a chicken, you should also give a little bit to tzedakah. And of course, many people are nohik only to do kaparos with tzedakah. And if you happen to do kaparos with a chicken, of course, there are many Ashkenazim, most Ashkenazim think that's a good idea. You should also be careful, as Rosh Hashulchan points out, as many of the Achronim point out, that the meat is properly processed. There's very little benefit to Erev Yom Kippur performing a minhag that chas v'chalila results in someone eating non-kosher food. So I hope that this will help you to understand and to ensure that you're not only zocher to do kaparos, but you're also zocher to, if you so choose, to have kosher meat that you can eat or perhaps give to an ani who doesn't know where the chicken came from. Thank you very much for listening.